really pleased to introduce Fiona Noonan, who is the head of the International Development Department at the University of Birmingham. And I've had the pleasure to get to know Fiona over the last year or so, because she and Mary and I were involved in this governance project where we basically did a literature review of practically all the literature on governance related to ecosystem services. So I think it's fair to say that Fiona has become, already was, and is an expert in the issue of governance. And in her own work, she's focused in particular on mangroves and inland fisheries, which I think is a great addition to a lot of what we talk about in this seminar series, which is very often focused more terrestrially. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'd also like to point out that we have a really good list of speakers coming up for the rest of the term, including Professor Chris Thomas, who wrote his well-known best-selling book on Inheritors of the Earth, How Nature is Thriving in an Age of Extinction. So that's next week on the 16th. And then the 2nd of March, Ted Feldposh will talk on historical fire in Amazonia. And then finally, March 9th, Simon Lewis on Congo's hidden peatlands. So without further ado, pass it over to Fiona.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for coming. So the focus of my talk today is on the complexity of the governance of mangrove forests, drawing on fieldwork undertaken in Kenya and Zanzibar. And I want to sort of reflect on the implications for sustainability and livelihoods of that complexity of the governance landscape. So just to give you an overview then of my talk this afternoon, I'm firstly going to briefly introduce the projects that I'm drawing on in this talk this afternoon, and reflect a little bit more about why the focus on mangrove forests. I'm then going to introduce several approaches or perspectives that have been taken to analysing complex governance, and these are multi-level, network and polycentric governance. They are sort of fairly similar, but they have some sort of subtle differences and areas of literature around them. So what I am doing in using them is identifying some common themes and then applying them to what I call the landscape of governance of mangrove forests in Kenya and Zanzibar. And I use that term landscape because I don't want to make any sort of assumptions about what the governance situation looks like. And so I'm assuming that the governance landscape is quite mixed and messy, and you know, there's no one fixed governance system. Then we'll reflect on some of the findings and implications of that analysis and identify some potential future research directions. And I'm doing that because I'm very aware that I feel like I don't have some of the answers that we could do with having to addressing complexity in natural resource governance. And then I'll finish with some concluding observations. So where did this interest in governance come from in relation to mangrove forests? Well, they come from, and what I will be drawing on, is two projects that were funded by the Ecosystem Services for Poverty Alleviation Programme. Some of you may be familiar with ESPA. The first one was called Swahili Seas, and the Swahili Seas project was concerned with supporting the development of a payment for ecosystem services scheme in Ghazi Bay in Kenya. That payment for ecosystem services scheme is one of the only mangrove forests payment for ecosystem services scheme in the world. And so it was a sort of a mix of a development and a research project. And so we had to undertake certain research to support the application for the PES programme. And it was building on previous projects and previous interaction that other people in the project had had with both government and the communities in Ghazi Bay. So there was that project. And through the research and through the development of the PES scheme, it became apparent that the governance situation was quite important in terms of how the PES scheme may or may not work, and certainly into the future as well. And so we took that up a bit more in a subsequent project called Coastal Ecosystem Services in East Africa. We did research there in Kenya and in Zanzibar. In Kenya, we undertook research at the national level and a different area, not in Ghazi Bay, but in somewhere called Vanga. And that was that project was really concerned with how you could expand a pest scheme that focused on mangrove forests. And in terms of expansion, I mean incorporating seagrass meadows. Oh, and how could you replicate pest schemes? And so governance was a key part of that project. So in terms of thinking then about why mangrove forests, there are certain sort of characteristics then of mangrove forests that make the governance quite interesting and quite challenging. First of all, I'm sure as in with the many forest situations, there's concern about degradation and deforestation, and that's certainly the case in both Kenya and Zanzibar. Neither places have seen widespread clearance as there has been in some other countries, particularly for shrimp aquaculture, but there has been sort of deforestation and forest degradation, and as you can see the drivers of those are listed here: for timber extraction, clearing for salt extraction, and there's pollution and sedimentation. Those are the drivers of loss in Kenya, and in Zanzibar similar drivers of loss, although particularly an additional issue there is charcoal production, which has really led to a lot of deforestation in some locations. And in Kenya, given the development of the pest scheme, there's been a lot of work done on estimating the carbon sequestration of potential of the mangrove forest, and as you can see the estimate there. And so mangrove forests are recognised as being an important store, an important sink for carbon, and so that's another reason to be interested in conservation and in what difference governance can make for that. I thought I'd better show you a couple of maps then to show you where these mangrove forests can be found in Zanzibar and Kenya. And so in Zanzibar you can see that the less populated island of Pemba, there's much more mangrove coverage, and you can see that it's in the sort of the sort of inlets and the estuaries, whereas in the sort of main Unguja island, where it's much more populated, there's much more sort of economic activity, there's less mangrove forest coverage. In Kenya, I'm sorry, it's not quite as sharp, this map, but you can see there's quite, you know, widespread mangrove coverage along the coast. You can see Mombasa there. Gazi Bay is just a little bit down from Mombasa, and then Vanga is further down again, close to the Tanzanian border. So that shows you where mangrove forests are found then. Now the purpose of this slide is to illustrate the diversity of ecosystem services associated with mangrove forests. Now of course mangrove forests are found at the land-sea interface, and so they offer and provide a multitude of ecosystem services. This particular figure shows the estimated economic value in US dollars of these different ecosystem services, but the point of me showing you this figure is really just to show you the diversity. So we've got everything from timber, fuel wood and honey, to mangrove forest providing a nursery area for fish and for crustaceans, a breeding area and a nursery, and so they're very important for fisheries. And of course mangrove forests also provide protection against coastal erosion and against extreme weather events, and carbon sequestration, of course, as well. So there's lots of ecosystem services that mangrove forests provide, and because of that, you get many sectors of government being involved or affecting how a mangrove forest is used and managed. In most countries, the management of a mangrove forest will be undertaken or led by the forestry department, of course. But we can see, given how important mangrove forests are for fisheries, so the type of management priorities or the management approaches a fisheries department takes would also have an impact on the condition or the status of mangrove forests. And then, given the importance of mangrove forests for coastal protection and to protect against coastal erosion, then any part of government that's responsible for coastal protection, coastal zone management, they will also, how they decide to prioritise or whatever measures they bring in will also have an impact on mangrove forests. So we can see then that there are going to be many sectors of government and then many actors and many other actors involved in governing mangrove forests. Another reason for focusing then on mangrove forests, I mentioned that both in Zanzibar and Kenya there's been significant deforestation, forest degradation. And so how can we address that? And so looking at the governance, the complexity of the governance system is one way of thinking about, you know, how can we better address this degradation and deforestation. And that's an aerial photograph of Kenya there. I also said a little bit about this Payment for Ecosystem Services scheme. And so what that PES scheme is doing then is tapping into global carbon trading. The PES scheme is community-based, and so the benefits go back to the community. But this is important in terms of the governance landscape because it brings in additional actors into the governance system. And it's done that both at the local level, with the supporting the formation of a community forest association, at the national level through bringing in interests of the part of government that leads on climate change, and through the international, at the international level, through the sort of approval, the certification, and this obviously selling of the credits. So there are good reasons then for being interested in the governance of mangrove forests, I would argue. And just to say a little bit more then about that governance landscape, and what we find in natural resource settings, so there are some common themes and approaches that have been taken over the years, certainly since the 1980s, to the governance of renewable natural resources. And these include a decentralisation of government functions, so you'll often find forestry, fisheries, environment officers, both at the national level and at the local government level, whether it's district, county. And you may also find a delegation of a government function. So you may have, officers that are both employed by local government and officers who report directly to the national government. So decentralisation then is a common theme and a common approach taken. There are also many different types of participatory approaches within natural resource governance. And they tend to be quite separate within the multiple sectors. So you'll have participatory approaches within forestry, within fisheries, within the environment, within coastal conservation. And one of the common themes of these sort of participatory approaches is that although they do give some voice and some say and some responsibilities to local actors, to resource users, the government very often remains powerful. Another common approach and a theme within natural resource governance is the adoption of certification and, of course, the introduction of these PES schemes. And that brings in additional challenges of the involvement of private sector, NGOs, and issues of scale and multi-scalar linkages. And then within the mangrove context, we have this land-sea interface that brings in these sort of additional challenges. So in terms of what we did then in these two projects, well, particularly in the second project, in terms of trying to understand the governance context, is that we began with quite a separate focus on the local level and on the national level. And it was only later that we really brought that together and took a much more clearer sort of multi-level perspective. So we began with undertaking interviews and focus group discussions at the local level, trying to understand the dynamics and the arrangements of governance of mangrove forests at the local level. I say mangrove forest. We actually also covered fisheries because of the interest in seagrass meadows. So there was that sort of already brought in an intersectoral dimension to it. Another stream of the research was concerned with shadowing a government department responsible for forestry. And the purpose of that was to try to understand how these departments worked, trying to understand the sort of culture, the norms, the ways of working, and what those sort of ways of working that would either make community forestry type approaches or participatory approaches either possible or perhaps quite difficult. So it's about really getting into the heart of government and to understand a bit more about how they function and how they work with communities. And so we had these sort of two quite separate streams of research activity going on, but then came to realise that it would be important to bring them together a bit more and to do more work in different sectors at the national level that we hadn't really sort of captured. And so we conducted additional funding from ESPA and conducted additional key informant interviews and held workshops in both countries to discuss issues around these sort of multiple levels and issues around how sectors and actors either work together or coordinate and what sort of challenges they experience. And so that's what I'll be drawing on today. And so what I'm trying to do then in this presentation and the paper that I'm working on at the moment that is related to this presentation is to understand how the landscape of the governance of mangrove forests can be characterised. What are the key characteristics of the landscape of mangrove governance? What are the implications of that, those characteristics, for the sustainable use and conservation of mangrove forests? I thought I'd better define governance before I go any further, because certainly something we found in the projects I've been working on with Mary and Connie is that very often the term isn't defined and it's used very differently, interpreted very differently, and often taken for granted what it means. And so I like this definition. I think it reflects how I understand governance or natural resource governance. And so this definition then is that natural resource governance is the norms, institutions and processes that determine how power and responsibilities over natural resources are exercised, how decisions are taken and how citizens secure access to, participate in, are impacted by the management of natural resources. And so whilst I'm focusing much more on sort of structures and arrangements in this presentation, I recognise that governance is much more than that. It does include the norms, the institutions, and the sort of processes that go on within and around those structures and arrangements. And I think another important point to note then from this definition, and it's certainly recognised in the literature, is that governance is different from management. That management goes on and through governance arrangements. But when we're focusing on governance, we're very much interested in who is making decisions. Why is it those actors or those structures that are making decisions? Who's missing out and whose voices are not being heard? Those kinds of issues, rather than on the management measures themselves. Although we would obviously be interested in why those management measures were decided upon and what they look like, etc. So there are close relationships between management and governance, but it's useful to see them as quite different approaches. So just to say a little bit more then about why governance tends to be complicated, even, you know, we're outside of the mangrove context. We've also already recognised you often get multiple benefits from ecosystem services, and we know, of course, that social and ecological systems are themselves complex systems, and then once you start thinking about the interactions between them, things can even get more complicated. And of course our focus then is on governance and not just government, so that means that there are many other types of actors involved other than government. So that may include customary institutions, there may be a range of actors involved because of the decentralisation of services, participation of resource users, etc. And perhaps I should just mention the last bullet point there, because I haven't said a lot about that so far. But when we're thinking about the governance context of renewable natural resources, we need to think about the value chain and the involvement of actors along the value chain, because that can have implications for the decisions that are made and the status of a natural resource as well. And I thought I would just reflect as well, before I get on to the theory of governance, of complex governance, that actually, when we think about government policy and government departments, because one of the critiques of thinking about complex governance is that too often governments work sectorally, is that actually, within any sector, the government is constrained, and it's very difficult for a government to actually deliver on a policy because it needs other actors. In our lives and in the natural world, we'll find that things aren't so delineated between sectors. They interact. Any issue or situation will be affected by multiple policies. And so actors need to work together to actually deliver on any policy objectives. So it's not unique to natural resources, it's not unique to mangrove forests, certainly. Okay, right, so we're finally getting to the theoretical approaches then have been taken to analysing complex governance. I've just chosen these three. I nearly included ecosystem governance as well, but I thought that was probably too many, and the literature on ecosystem governance is quite new in a way and emerging, and probably borrows from some of these ideas as well. And it's hard to completely delineate these three approaches. There are overlaps, and sometimes people will talk about polycentric multi-level governance, for example. But I've tried to keep them a little bit separate so that we can identify some of the defining characteristics of these approaches. So when you look at literature then on multi-level governance, what they tend to be talking about is the structures and institutions at multiple administrative levels of government. And with an attention to interactions within and across levels, there's a lot of discussion then about horizontal and vertical interactions. Another way of thinking about complex governance and how actors interact is by seeing the governance situation as a network. There are different ways of doing that in the literature and in practice. So to some extent, social network analysis has been used to map actors. But network governance itself goes a bit further, and that's suggesting that actors will interact with a range of actors, not limited by sectors or levels, but by trying to get things done, trying to achieve some objective. So they recognise that there are intractable problems, that these complex social ecological problems need to be addressed, and how can they do that? So a network emerges. And through that networking, decisions emerge. So network governance can exist within different forms of governance arrangements. It's not necessarily a separate form of governance, and it's not necessarily the case that there was a conscious decision to form a network, although there can be. And then finally, polycentricity. This is slightly different again, in that this comes from research that was really undertaken in municipalities, and from much more urban research. It comes from a different setting, and that suggests that there are multiple centres that operate at different locations with different remits, but somehow they work together for common objectives, common purposes, and coordinate through a self-organised governance regime. And a further characteristic of a polycentric governance arrangement then is that there are nested structures at different levels, and that they relate from one level to the next, and through reporting, information sharing, etc. We'll see a little bit more about that in a moment. So then these three approaches, these three perspectives, have some common themes of recognising multiple government sectors and multiple government faces, if you like. Multiple actors, policies, institutions, multiple interactions, that they are all recognising the need to respond to the complex problems of this, of how do you achieve sustainable use of renewable natural resources. A further common theme is on coordination and collaboration, either in terms of suggesting that they have the answer to coordination or recognising that coordination is in itself a challenge, and you know, how can you work within the systems to improve coordination. The difference in terms of the degree of hierarchy and network, so the network approach in particular suggests that the hierarchies can be overcome and they're not meaningful and then helpful to be constrained by those levels. And with all, in all three approaches then, they recognise that because of this complexity, there arise certain challenges for governance performance, particularly in terms of accountability. How do you know which actor or which system to hold to account? Where is the legitimacy of the system? And is there any transparency? And how does representation work within those systems? I thought I'd better break up the presentation for a moment and just show you some photos before I get on to the analysis. So this is a lovely aerial shot then of mangrove forests in Kenya. I was very fortunate that there was a project last year, a UN project, that's taken an awful lot of commons license photos that we can use of the Kenyan mangroves. So that's very grateful to them for that. So that's a very nice shot of the mangrove forest there. They don't look too bad from here. And then just showing you the obviously the close relationship between fisheries and forests there, sort of local fishermen there with their boats close to the forest edge. And then a couple of shots showing the sort of timber that's extracted from the mangrove forests. In Zanzibar, you're not supposed to take any timber at all. I think you can get permission for house construction, but obviously there is illegal logging, particularly for charcoal production. In Kenya, the Kenyan Forest Service will provide a licensee with a license to extract a certain amount of timber per year from an area of a mangrove forest, and that licensee will employ a number of cutters to act on their behalf. But I think what we have found is that that monitoring in terms of how much they're taking is a little bit suspect, and there isn't really any sort of scientific rationale either for the limit they put on the amount of timber that can be extracted. But anyway, so there are some sort of governance issues around the extraction of timber as well. Okay, so what I'm going to do in the next few slides then is apply each of those three perspectives to see what they can tell us about the complexity of the system of mangrove governance. I should say that just to keep things simple, I haven't included NGOs and perhaps some other actors in this slide, partly because they're found at all of those levels. They tend to be particularly active with project funding. So what we have found is that obviously NGOs can be very important in facilitating action, in working between government and communities, but they're not always present because obviously they themselves are dependent on funding. But we can certainly see the case if we look at the policies, the management strategies, and speak to the government departments. So there are many government departments that have an interest in mangrove forests, as I sort of set out earlier. In both cases, they have a decentralised system of government. In Kenya, that system is quite new, and so what we have found is that the responsibilities are still being negotiated in all of these sectors, and that brings out sort of certain challenges as well, particularly when it comes to anything related to revenue raising, so issuing licences, for example. At the local level, many different structures are relevant to the mangrove governance situation. Certainly the village head. In both countries, you have some form of community-based forest association. And the same for fisheries. So in Kenya, the fisheries system is called beach management units, and in Zanzibar, it's the fisheries committee. The beach management units operate within a system of fisheries co-management, and so that means that they work with the fisheries department. They're not a sort of solely community-based structure. And similarly with the fisheries committee in Zanzibar, although they are very closely linked to marine protection and tend to come under the sort of marine MPA type legislation rather than fisheries. And then in Kenya, in Ngazi Bay specifically, we have that international connection through the carbon trading through Makoko Pamoja. Now, then, in terms of network governance, for those of you who are familiar with social network analysis, this is how a network is often portrayed, you know, a whole range of interactions taking place between actors, not constrained by levels or sectors. That isn't my network diagram, I should confess. I didn't do a social network analysis, but I just wanted to illustrate what those sorts of interactions could look like. But what we found was, in terms of networking, is that there are already... You know, there is already a lot of interaction going on between the sectors, between actors, between levels. And there are these sort of opportunities for networking include both formal and informal. So the more formal processes tend to involve one department, one sector writing formal invitation letters to another through the director to invite another sector to participate in a meeting, a workshop, some fieldwork activity. And very often, these opportunities are externally funded. So very often, there'll only be the funding for these types of interactions to take place if there is a donor-funded project. So they tend to be ad hoc, and they may often also be dependent on an individual officer's social networks. You know, who do they know? And they may have a relation in another department, or somebody they went to school with, somebody they've met. And so it's very reliant on those informal social relations as well. But there are many challenges to those kind of networked interactions taking place. They're very much around actors or sectors being confined by their remit, not wanting to overstep their mandate. I've mentioned already this reliance on donor funding. And we have certainly found that there's limited interaction between those community-based structures that I noted on the previous slide. So you have many community-based structures that are formed by sectors. So you have the Forestry Association, fisheries, sometimes environment related to coastal conservation. But they don't interact a lot. They tend to operate quite sort of vertically, reporting upwards, and don't collaborate, don't cooperate very much in practice. And so there's this hierarchical formation of structures and reporting. And if we look at this same environment from a polycentric perspective, we can see a similar themes emerging of quite separate sectors. This illustrates that nested characteristic of polycentric governance that I mentioned earlier. And you can see there that at the bottom that... these community-based structures are sort of nested within the decentralized system of government within the sort of sectors. And so they're reporting upwards very often. They await instructions or they only carry out elections, for example, for their committees when they're told to do so by a government officer. And they're waiting for resources and guidance, if you like, from the relevant government department. So I think the polycentric perspective shows that quite well, how that nested approach takes place. Before I sort of reflect on those sort of observations, that's very much sort of focused on the government the governance structures and arrangements. I just want to look into a little bit more about some of the policies and strategies and see what they've got to say about other sectors, coordination and integration, etc. And there is actually, certainly in recent years, been very much an emphasis on taking a more integrated approach. within both countries. And that's certainly been the case for the integrated coastal zone management policy and plan. But there are other opportunities. So, for example, in Kenya, through the County Governments Act and the County Development Plans, there's supposed to be an environment committee formed, more collaboration going on. And again in Kenya, last year the first National Mangrove Ecosystem Management Plan was approved. And so there are some opportunities for taking a more integrated approach. And in Zanzibar, again, they've also had this integrated coastal zone management. And what they are trying to do there is to form committees at the local level that bring together representatives of these different sectoral, natural resource sectoral committees. So perhaps there could be a way of having a more integrated, coordinated approach. But that's when I was there last year, just a few had only recently been formed, and so that's very much in the early stages. So we have a commitment to integrated management. And what we also find, I'm just looking here on this slide at Kenya, that there is also a recognition that that sectoral approach that we find in the coastal area, it is recognised as being a problem. So that mangrove ecosystem management plan says that one of the major challenges facing the management of resources at the coast is the sectoral governance system, which doesn't recognise the interconnectedness of ecosystems. And again, the integrated coastal zone management policy also refers to the sectorial approach. And the coastal zone management plan talks about poorly planned and uncoordinated coastal development resulting from that sectoral approach and weak institutional legal frameworks that do not adequately address the complex cross-sectoral problems. So there is recognition then in policy and in plans that this is an issue. But when I'm turning to the findings, what we can find from those policy documents and from the workshops and interviews that we conducted, that there is that rhetoric of integrated management, but the governance arrangements and practices suggest that governance is fragmented. The sectors, they have these different remits, objectives, priorities, ways of working and norms. And so what we find then is in those policy documents, they're very careful to make sure that they reference policies of other sectors, that they acknowledge and acknowledge how those sort of policies have commonalities. But it's almost like a tick box exercise, because what they don't do then is see, you know, how the sectors could work together. If you are going to take an integrated approach, if those policy documents suggest that integrated management is a priority, there's no reflection on how that might happen given the sort of sectoral governance arrangements. And there is a lack of incentives then to share resources and the lack of incentives to really challenge the remit. And that's particularly due to the desire to ensure attribution. Now, you're going to want to say we achieved this, or we've restored this area of mangroves, or we've set up this number of associations. You're not going to want to share the glory, if you like, with other government departments. So that attribution is also a challenge to gaining more coordination. So what we can certainly see that is governance is hierarchical in both countries, with community-based structures nested within the decentralised and devolved structures. And so it reflects the fact that what we find in practice, as in many countries that have participatory management approaches, that actually there's very limited power sharing, and governments are quite careful in terms of how much responsibility they're willing to give over to community-based approaches. And so, as I've said already, that the structures at the village level then operate on a siloed basis with little interaction. They, particularly in Zanzibar, they do report to village government, but not to the wider community. And there's no coordination between those structures. And NGOs present in all sectors, not really cutting across the sectors. And they support community-based management and working with government, but they're also, as I say, themselves dependent on project funding. And so that perhaps limits, you know, what they're able to do and how long they're able to support these sort of processes. So then in terms of thinking back to identify some common themes of this the multi-level network or polycentric governance, and those common themes are identified in the first column. So what we find then in Kenya and Zanzibar is that there are indeed multiple sectors, multiple faces of government, there's a range of different actors, there's a range of different types of interactions. They can be formal and informal, joint activities often reliant on donor-funded projects. There's a recognition that sustainable governance of or management of natural resources is a complex, intractable problem, but actually a limited response to that. And coordination and collaboration then tends to be ad hoc and opportunistic. And there's some coordination of policy, but perhaps not of the management or the actual sort of governance structures. And the governance arrangements themselves then tend to be quite hierarchical and multi-level rather than much evidence of networking. And then in terms of challenges then to the governance performance that results from that situation or those characteristics, we find that representation of resource users, whilst you've got those participatory management approaches, tends to be quite limited at the higher levels, and accountability, as in many cases elsewhere, tends to be upwards rather than down to communities, and there's limited transparency. So what can we conclude then from that analysis that in terms of the actual sort of theoretical perspectives? Well, we can certainly see that the multi-level perspective does bring out the complexity and the number and diversity of actors, policies, processes, structures, and of course interactions. There doesn't seem to be much evidence of actually a network governance approach, but thinking about network governance does enable you then to identify some of the challenges to networking, which is, I think, is useful in itself. And certainly in terms of thinking about polycentricity, there's certainly evidence of that nested approach, and that really highlights the challenges there of taking that more siloed approach to governance. And so we can conclude then that governance in this situation is quite fragmented, with limited evidence of shared objectives, collaboration and cooperation. So what does that mean then for the mangrove forests? Well, we can see that there's some recognition of that mangrove forests, as with other coastal ecosystems, needs to be managed in an integrated ecosystem-based way, but there hasn't been responded to in terms of sort of structures and arrangements. There's also some recognition, as we saw in Kenya, that those governance arrangements may be a problem, but there's no sort of real solutions of as yet put forward to that. I should just say, though, that I've really focused on the governance arrangements here, but that's not the only thing that we need to think about when we're thinking about degradation and deforestation of mangrove forests. I don't want to undermine everything I've said so far, but what we have found that what really matters as well is the location of the mangrove forest in relation to resource users. So if people live very close to a mangrove forest, they'll use it a lot, whereas if it's a bit further away and it's harder to get to, then obviously they won't use it quite so much. The existence of alternative livelihoods also matters. You know, if people have got a choice, you know, they may not necessarily rely so much on the mangrove forest, particularly in the case of Zanzibar for charcoal. And accessibility matters as well. So if your village is very accessible by a good tarmac road, then there may be more timber extraction, there may be more charcoal production. So there are other factors. I mean, obviously those relate to governance, but it's important to think beyond the governance context as well as to what else is going on and what else is affecting and driving degradation and deforestation. So I feel that so far and in the research and in the literature more widely, there are some gaps to be addressed and to be thought about. And that includes the very question of, okay, we're assuming through thinking about complex governance that coordination is something desirable, but what we find in practice is very hard to deliver on whether we're talking about a developing country context or even in industrialised countries. I think government departments often work quite separately, and taking an integrated approach is quite difficult. So if coordination is desirable, how could it be incentivised and sustained over time? And I think what we also found through looking at taking this multi-level perspective is that not just because of these sectoral approaches, but those sectoral approaches are not helping the situation of sustaining community-based or participatory approaches over time. So, you know, there's creating this sort of plethora of structures that almost grow into a halt when donor funding dries up or they're not sort of substituted by government funding. So how could those sort of structures, those approaches, be made more effective and sustainable? Given limited power sharing and sectors operating independently, I think is an important area for research that should also, of course, take that multi-level perspective as well. So to conclude then, my concluding slide, I think mangroves illustrate very well the complexity of natural resource commons, which have multiple uses and beneficiaries. We can see that the governance system is quite fragmented, there's a lack of coordination, and that's related as well to different framings of mangroves, different ways that mangroves are viewed by the different sectors. And coordination then is very challenging. There's little evidence of measures that work. Within the wider literature, though, there's greater increasing attention given to what was called sort of boundary organisations or boundary spanners, either sort of structures or individuals that are able to make connections between sectors, and perhaps brokers as well that are able to broker relationships between actors. And so I think then that drawing on these three perspectives rather than taking one perspective brings different insights to the analysis of complex governance of social ecological systems. Thank you.